Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Okay, welcome to the Pigpen. I'm R.C. Christensen, and I'm a guest host today. That's because I'm going to be interviewing Darren Hayes, who normally hosts this show, because he has written a great book, and I want everyone to know more about it. So how are you doing today, Darren?
RC, I am doing great. And thank you for this kind offer of sort of turning the tables here. I'm sitting on the other side of the desk during this interview. Actually, we're doing a Zoom call. But this is a great honor, and I appreciate you bringing this up. Great idea.
Well, you've written a great book. And so the book, if people haven't heard yet, Darren has written a book called The World's Greatest Pro Gridiron Team, the 1903 Franklin All-Stars. And this is a book that's brand new this month. Is that correct?
Yeah, it came out right before Thanksgiving. So a little over a month old now.
Okay, so it's actually been out a little while. Okay. All right. And I as soon as I found out about this book, I raced out and bought it and I read it in one day. And I've got a bunch of questions about the book, Darren. So do you want to just get into it?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So the 1903 Franklin All-Stars, I'm pretty sure, you know, you ask anybody, they're going to be like, what is that team, right? So why don't you tell everyone, why did you choose to write about this team?
Well, exactly what you just said. I've lived like 40, 50 miles away from Franklin. I work with a bunch of people that are either grew up in Franklin or still live in Franklin. And when I asked them about the 1903 Franklin team, they said, what, Franklin had a football team? And it's a common thing. It's the first time I ever heard of them was probably 4 or 5 years ago, reading a PFRA Old Coffin Corner article. I think Coffin Corner has a couple articles on Franklin, probably from the late 70s, early 80s. And it was, because Franklin is in my area, and I officiated some high school games down there for Franklin High School against Oil City High School, who are sort of the main protagonists and antagonists in this story, as team-wise. It caught my interest, and I said, I got to learn more about this, and I dove into it, you know, and just a great story, and it's great for the locality around us, and it's great for football, and it's a story that needs to be told.
Well, the first thing that people see, of course, on a book is the cover, and the cover features a picture of the team, and also, of course, the title. So the title, again, is The World's Greatest Pro Gridiron Team, with the subtitle The 1903 Franklin All-Stars. So the title of the book is quite a statement. How did you decide it was the best, most suitable title for this book?
Pretty arrogant title, isn't it? Kind of talking. Well, I actually didn't call them the world's greatest pro gridiron team. The Franklin Evening News back in 1903 was calling them the greatest team, greatest on earth. Was, you know, very common on a daily newspaper article they wrote about this team. I mean, this is 1903, 3 years before the forward passes in football. The football field looks like a giant grid, and that's where they got the term gridiron, because there's 5 yard squares all over the field in that era. And this team was a team of, they were the Franklin All-Stars. Well, they were truly a team of all-stars. And they really, after reading up on them and doing some research and jotting down the data and the numbers, which we'll talk about in a little bit, I think they really might have been the world's greatest pro gridiron team. I think the papers got it right 120 years ago.
And they really do come across as just a strong opponent for everyone that they faced. Just a little bit more about the book. One of the features of this book is, do you have bonus content? And so the reader sees QR codes and they can use their phone and jump out there and listen to interviews and things like that. When and why did you decide to include bonus content? What was the driver for that?
Well, just like you, I read a lot of football books. For a while there, I'm doing maybe 5 or 6 football, history books a month, and I mixed them up. I had some eBooks, I had some regular old fashioned, hardback books and paperbacks, and read them on PDFs. And I like different aspects of each of those genres of reading. I like the eBooks, how you can jump to a hyperlink and go to someplace else to get some bonus content. And I said, and I use a lot of QR codes in my job, working in a factory here in Erie. And I said, boy, I know how to do the QR codes. And I wanted it to really be an extension of Pigskin Dispatch, the website and the podcast. And I'm honored to have a lot of great friends that know a lot of things about that era. So I talked to a few of them, with Ken Crippen and Timothy P. Brown, Joe Ziemba, and we put some things together that just tell the rest of the story. I tried to stay focused on Franklin and that 1903 season that they had, and I let some of the other things, like learning what a line buck is. Timothy P. Brown is a great collegiate historian from the turn of the last century and into the 1920s. I said, what a perfect person to have tell that, what a line buck is. And he educated me on it too, as well as a couple other things. And some of them was me reaching out and asking some questions, because, asking Ken Crippen about a Syracuse, team, an all Syracuse team, which I knew a little bit about, but not much, but he grew up in that area and that's his area of expertise. And, that's, I thought, was very appropriate, and it was great that they got to be involved with the book, and it makes a little bit special experience. And I'm not sure, I don't know of anybody else that's done QR codes like that, taking them to podcasts. There's one link that takes you to a game that was filmed during the time of this book, 1903. Thomas Edison filmed what was many believe is the oldest footage of live football, the Harvard-Yale game in 1903. So I connected them to the YouTube page of somebody else's video of that, which is kind of cool too.
Yeah, and as a reader, it was kind of nice sometimes to, take a break from the task of reading and just listen or watch or what have you. So it's a kind of a nice addition to this type of book. I think, people might see it as an opportunity for, things that they might be publishing in the future. So the 1903 Franklin All-Stars, you said there was a couple of PFRA articles that kind of spurred things for you. After when you look back on all the research that you did do, where did you actually get the bulk of your information then for this book?
Well, a lot of it was going back to that old newspaper, going through newspapers.com. The Franklin newspaper was a wealth of information. Like I said, this was they were pretty ticked at Oil City from the year before. So, and this is before sports journalism. So this was just like a regular newspaper. It was almost a daily column. Anything that was going on from the beginning of October through the middle of December, almost daily, they had something on this Franklin team, because here was a bunch of out-of-towners that came into their town. I mean, Franklin's not a very big town, even to this day. They're bigger back in 1903 than they are today even. So anybody that come in as a visitor to their town, that was big news. And these were folks, that were heroes and walking the streets and, eating at the restaurants and anything else, playing catch out in the street, probably who knows what they were doing, chasing the young ladies. So they got their news. Anything they did was in that newspaper, and it was a great wealth of information. Also, the Venango Historical Society, which is in downtown Franklin, and it's actually in an old building right next to where General Charles Miller ran the Galena Signal Oil Corporation, and Charles Miller was sort of the main financier of the team. But it's right next door to his office building. You can look right out the window and you can see it. And a kind of neat thing, when I was down there with my father and I were doing some research down there earlier this year, and there was a giant desk there, and the lady that was running Historical Society said, "Oh yeah, that was General Charles Miller's desk. We just bought it at an auction recently." So I'm sitting there, you know, touching General Charles Miller's desk, looking out the window that's facing his old building, and doing research on his fabulous football team he put together.
Boy, that's great. Yeah, it's those moments that really stand out to you when you're doing research. So where do you think you found the most valuable piece of information while you were?
Well, that is really hard to say, because there was such a wealth of, I mean, the PFRA article was great, and that sort of eluded me. They got most of their information from a book that was published probably about 15 years after this. It was right around World War One. They published a look back at the rivalry of Oil City and Franklin in baseball. But it was a little booklet that the newspaper had put out, probably 20 pages long. And in it, they had one chapter on this. They called it the 1904 championship team. They were a little bit errant on their year. And the PFRA sort of picked up on that. They were off by a year. And they had some of the names wrong. And so the PFRA again followed suit. So I could tell that, Mr. Carroll, or whoever wrote this article, I'm not sure who wrote the article, was just off a little bit, because they got some information from somebody trying to recollect, some 15 years later. And, some of the names, like they were calling the manager Bill Prince, it's, actually Dave Prince. And I got that information from the historical record, and the newspapers of 1903 also told that story. So there's a lot of good information in all of them that I took a little bit from each.
Okay. No, that's great. It's always good to hear when you're able to, find errors which are understandable, and then correct them as you can. So the correcting the record is part of what I think drives some of us to do what we do. So when did you know that you could actually make a book out of this? At what point did you realize that, wait, this could be a whole thing?
Well, I was so enamored with it. And at first I was just going to write, I did write a story on Pigskin Dispatch probably about a year and a half ago about it. And I got into it, and I read it, and I wanted to just get the story out on a certain date. And so I told the story almost, very, taking a lot of information from what I learned from the PFRA's thing. And I bought that little booklet I told you, I got a copy of it. They had a commemorative issue come out, Venango Historical Society did in 2012. I was able to get my hands on a copy of that. I bought through them. And so I had the actual, print, what they had in there, not the original, but the copyrighted thing that they made years later. And I got into that story a little bit, and I said, man, then I started looking at it at newspapers.com, and I said, oh, there's so much more to this. And I always said, want to write a book, talking to people like yourself, RC, and some of the authors. I've had, hundred and some authors on Pigskin Dispatch talking about football. And you guys, I'm always amazed at how you tell a story. And I pick up a little bit from each of you. And when we get done talking, I always ask a few questions. So I always learn a lot from those who've done it. And I was always, had that little urge of me to write a book myself. And I said, boy, this is the perfect story for something in my area. And I think I'm the right guy to do this. So I was happy to be able to do this.
And one of the things that you mentioned earlier was, you talk about the rivalry with Oil City, but really football in the area, it sounds like, was kind of funded and grew out of oil financing. Is that right?
Oh yeah, you had Oil City and Franklin were both in the Venango County, which is with Titusville, which is another city nearby. I don't think Titusville had a football team, but oil, the first commercial oil well was founded by Edwin Drake, Drake's Follies, they called it, just a few miles away from where these three cities are. And that's what boomed these cities into being, oil men and immense wealth, a very rich. You know, New York City was, you could read articles where New York City was always saying, hey, maybe we need some extra money on the Wall Street. Let's go down to Franklin or go to Oil City, because that's where everything was happening. And they also, General Charles Miller also controlled a lot of the railways because he sold Signal Oil, which was lubricant for the locomotives. And he reinvested that money into some of the locomotive industry. So he owned the tracks, or a good portion of the rights to them, between New York City and Pittsburgh. And think about it, 1903, they're building skyscrapers in New York City. Where are they getting their steel from? Pittsburgh. So Carnegie's selling it up to, you know, the rich people, the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and, you know, everything up in New York City and Cleveland. So there's a big triumvirate. So that railway line was very lucrative in that area.
Okay. And so would you say, and this is jumping ahead a little bit in the book, but would you say that when they formed this 1903 team, that because of the wealth that was present, that they just spared no expense?
I think, well, first of all, they were a little bit mad. I mean, just a little bit backdrop. The year prior, well, they had a rivalry with Oil City because they were both growing up about the same time. They were both wealthy, industrious towns. So people had a little bit more free time because there was some money. So first it started off the local boys playing a local boys in baseball. Then it turned into football as football started to progress as a bigger sport and more popular sport. And then they both started bringing in some ringers, some outsiders to play and to coach. And it got to the point in 1902, they had three games scheduled. First time they played, they each had maybe one or two ringers on their team, and ended up, I think they had a tie game their first play, if I remember. I might be off on this. Second time they play, or no, I'm sorry, I think Oil City.
It was 6-5 Oil City, the first
Oil
one.
Oil City won that first one.
Yep. Right.
So Thanksgiving Day they play to a 0-0 tie, and Oil City's not happy about it. So at the same time, that same weekend, the original National Football League of 1902, which was a three-team league, had two Philadelphia teams based on the baseball teams, the Athletics and the Phillies, and a Pittsburgh team, the Pittsburgh Stars, that didn't have an affiliation with the Pirates, but there were some baseball stars that played on each of those because they were the athletes of the day. Well, so the Philadelphia Athletics played the Pittsburgh Stars in Pittsburgh for that championship of that league on what we would call Black Friday. So Oil City loses by, or I'm sorry, ties Franklin on Thanksgiving Day. They sent a representative down that night, hired the entire Philadelphia Athletics football team to play the very next day on Friday. Or I'm sorry, they played the championship on Friday. They play on Saturday, 2 days after the original game. And Oil City beats Franklin and takes them for money with a totally different team, I think, except for one player, you know, starting on that team. So Franklin people are really miffed. They've been hoodwinked. They paid their dues and they made bets for the next year. They did it in escrow accounts. And Charles Miller was, I think he must have lost a lot of money because he went to manager Dave Prince, who was sort of on and off as their manager in years past and didn't really participate a whole lot in 1902 as the manager. They had one of the players, one of the local guys was managing most of that year. But he hired Dave Prince and said, no, you're the manager next year, and I want a team. I don't care what it takes. I want a team that's going to beat Oil City next year, basically because they wanted their money back and they wanted their civic pride back.
So Dave Prince, just clarify, that's spelled P-R-I-N-T-Z. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's not like the artist formerly known as Prince. But Dave Prince, he was a clothing merchant. He had played football, though, before, right? With the Nursery City, Nursery Club 11?
Yeah, the Nursery Club, and that's sometimes what the Franklin team was still called, because the Nursery Club was a men's club. It was based, it was originally a literary club, and they sort of based it on the fact that they were a nursery of aspiring minds because of being all the literary cultivation that they were trying to do. So that's sort of what nursery wasn't like a nursery for, you know, they didn't have a bunch of babies or raising trees or anything. They were raising sharp young minds of gentlemen around the area of Franklin. And these people, eventually this club became a well-to-do club. The building still stands in Franklin. It was the Franklin Club for a while. Now it's a vacated building. Actually, they were trying to sell it when I was down there last time. It's a beautiful building, and it still looks the same way it does in the images I have in the book. You know, so it's very close to that. But anyway, that's what's sort of their, that was their headquarters, I guess you could say, because that's where everybody would go after work and probably have a few cocktails and shoot the breeze, maybe put together a football team at the same time. So, and Dave Prince did play for that. He played baseball for them. He played football for a couple years, and he really wasn't an athlete. He wasn't a large man, he did his best. And when some bigger talented guys came in the All-Stars, there really wasn't anybody that was a local in Franklin that could compete on a team. There were a few players, but they were sort of minor roles, you know, where they may have been a starter the year before. So that, but Dave Prince was a great mind of being able to talk to people and putting a team builder, I guess you could say, and, had a great mind for that.
Yeah, so Dave Prince was one of the key cogs in getting matchups and recruiting these All-Stars for 1903. But you do mention in the book that one of the other key people to think about is Tech Matthews. Why don't you speak a little bit more about Tech Matthews?
Yeah, Tech Matthews is sort of one of those original outsiders that the Franklin people brought in. They knew that they needed somebody that had a good football mind, that had played the game outside of Franklin. You know, a lot of teams were doing that all across the country. They were trying to bring college students or student athletes from the East that on successful programs to come to their town to teach them how to play the game of football and be a success. Well, they tried getting a couple different people. It sort of fell apart, and they came upon Tech Matthews, who was a superstar at Washington and Jefferson College, which is a little bit south of Pittsburgh, so still in western Pennsylvania. And Tech Matthews came up from Texas. He was a Native American and a great athlete. I think he set some W&J records at the time while he was down there. And was, one of the, I don't think he made All-American. I know he didn't make All-American, but he got pretty close to it. He was very well renowned as being a great running back. So he coached a team, I believe 1901 and 1902, he was the player coach. And 1903, he was still that manager. He had that pivotal role. And he used some of those connections he had at W&J to bring some of the other athletes to the 1903 team. And, so the other ones came from the East, from that original National Football League.
So I imagine when you wrote this article, you kind of had to work in reverse a little bit. You started with the 1903 team and moved backward. I'm guessing that's part of how it worked. So you had the information to start with about the 1903 team. How did you come to learn just how stacked that 1903 Franklin team really was? I mean, because I imagine what the information you started out with isn't the information that you ended up with. So at what point are you like, wow, they really were an all-star team?
Well, you're right. I sort of went backwards. I was trying to find a central character to the story to sort of tie it together, which ended up being Dave Prince. My first sight, was a name that I recognized was, Blondie Wallace was on this team. And I'm like, he had to be a central part of us. Well, he was, but he wasn't there from the beginning of the story. And then I sort of centered on Tech Matthews. I saw Tech's there. He came in, but he really wasn't at the beginning of the story. He was there through some of the rivalry games of Oil City and that, but he really fades out, has an illness, which sort of takes him out of commission from finishing the story. But Dave Prince is there sort of from the beginning and grew up in the town and all the way through till the end. And it just amazed me the names that were coming up in there in association. When they're talking, first they're one of their Oil City players that they're playing against is Doc Ben Roller, who is probably the most prominent name in all of college football and professional football at the time. This guy was a stud, and he played for Oil City, and he was a key driver. So I did a little bit of study up on him. Eventually, he came and played the last couple of games with Franklin at the end of the 1903 season. And, you know, Blondie Wallace, who, you know, Greg Fusari wrote a great book. And Blondie Wallace is a prominent figure all the way through that with Greg's great-grandfather, Bob Schiering. And they sort of play against each other on different teams all the way through. So I knew some history of Blondie. But then you start seeing some of these other gentlemen that are coming in there, you know, have like Jack Lang and Twister Steinberg and Curly Davidson, Jack Hayden. Jack Hayden was a great Major League Baseball player, too. He played for the Connie Mack for the Philadelphia Athletics in baseball and under Connie Mack with the Philadelphia Athletics in football before he came to Franklin. And these names kept popping up when I read Greg's book talking about Maslin and Canton a few years later in a scandal in 1906. Well, some of these guys went over and played in Ohio after they played for Franklin and had great careers in Maslin and Canton and Shelby and Akron and some of those teams that formed the mythical Ohio League. So, they're big names in football at the time.
Okay. So one of the questions I have is, you know, we do this kind of research. We deal a lot with kind of secondary sources. You know, they straddle the world of primary sources when we're talking about newspapers, right? They're newspaper accounts, but they're not necessarily, you know, the people that are involved. Did you actually find any artifacts that were, you know, related directly to the people that were involved with the team?
Now, I did not find direct artifacts on there, but I found there was a lot of periphery stories. I got some good information down at the PFRA convention because it was down in Pittsburgh this past year in 2023. And actually, there was some good information because there was a few players that played on Franklin or played against Franklin that were in the Latrobe Historical Society. And they had, when we went down there and visited a big group of us from PFRA, they had books open on the shelves and pictures and things to talk about. And I made some connections with the ladies that work down there, got some information from about some of these guys. So it told some other parts of the story, or it told about the era of football that maybe I wasn't totally familiar with. Or, you know, they had like a full uniform, I think, of, you know, one of the gentlemen that played on the Latrobe team. And you got to see some of the equipment, you know, firsthand, which you don't always get to see, you know, up close and personal like that, which is, it was kind of an intimate setting too. You got to be right up against the glass if you wanted to see it. And you know how that was. So that was all helpful and inspiring, and, you know, got you pumped up for that. And that's right when I was writing right in the midst of writing the book. So it was kind of an exciting thing. And I did not have artifacts in my hand, but I had a lot of inspiration from artifacts of the era.
Which of the players on that team would you wish you had seen play? For me, it would be Twister Steinberg. Is that his name?
Yeah.
You had a good description there of the way he sort of twisted and lifted up his legs and stuff. And it reminded me of, I'm a fan of the Minnesota Vikings. So it reminded me of Chuck Foreman, the idea of him, you know, doing the spin move and things like that. So for me, Twister would have been someone that would have been fun to watch. Who was it that stood out to you while doing this research?
Well, I think and somebody I haven't even mentioned yet, and I think somebody I really connected to, that's Herman Kirchhoff. Now, Herman Kirchhoff, I had never heard the name before until I started doing the research, but then I got into it. I mean, this guy played for almost two decades, you know, played right in the mid-1890s, probably right after Pudge Heffelfinger. He might have been playing while Pudge Heffelfinger was, but he, I believe, played at Purdue a little bit, played under an assumed name. I'm not sure why he played under assumed name in college. Usually that was when they were in college and they played in the pros, but he did his first year at Purdue. And this last year he played under his own name, then went out west and played in Colorado and some like Denver Athletic Club or something like that. Played in Chicago's athletic circuit for a couple years professionally, came and played for in the original National Football League, played for the Pittsburgh Stars, played for Franklin, and then played for Canton, I think, right after that. So he played a lot of football on a lot of good teams and got a lot of good experience. So I sort of connected to him, and he was a big lineman. And at the time, linemen were allowed to run with a the ball. They had tackle back formation, and he was a tackle. And you know, everybody described him as being a giant of a man. And can you imagine having a one of these big guys today on our lines? You know, taking the ball, 300 pounder coming through the line. Herman wasn't 300 pounds, but and for us to connect to running the ball, through the A gap and, on short yardage, it's just it had to be a sight to see. So I kind of wish I'd love to see that. And just to meet him, I think it would be kind of cool.
Sounds like he might be one of the players that you'd want people to appreciate more a little bit. That he's kind of lost in the shuffle, maybe.
Absolutely. And actually, one of those bonus clips that we have, Joe Ziemba, who knows a lot about Chicago football. And I told Joe, I said, hey, do you know anything about this Herman Kirkhoff? He goes, yeah, I know a little bit. And Joe got under and did a really nice job of describing who Herman Kirkhoff is. That's one of the bonus things I'm very grateful that he did and told a little bit more about Herman. So yeah, I want to get Herman's name out there and Jack Hayden, the quarterback, because I think he was a fantastic player. Curly Davis. I mean, they're all these guys are just great. You know, Asa Schrantz and, it's just a WD McNulty. And it's just some of these guys just, I connect to them. I think I know them. Like I've watched them all season because I read about them all season, but you really become connected to these characters and the characters of what they did.
Well, you recount a number of different games, and which game do you think you would have liked to have witnessed? The obvious one might be, one of the, well, there is no obvious one for me, actually, when I think about it, because, they actually lost that series to Oil City in 1902. So when you get to 1903, this was such a dominant team. Which game is the one that you would have wanted to see?
Well, it might be the obvious ones might be one of the ones in Madison Square Garden against, in particular Watertown, who Watertown was touted as being the top team in the world at the time. Just
and
like
they
Franklin
still exist.
Was and they still exist. You're right. I think they're the oldest professional team still going, so the Red and Blacks. And I tried to get some more information about them, and their historian guy who played for the Red and Blacks probably 20 years ago, he was unable to connect with me and help me out a little bit. But he probably didn't want to tell the story of Watertown back then because they lost to Franklin. But anyway, but I think the game of that season, 1903 season, I would have liked to see was the East End game. Because the East End, which is the old Jay Layless team from Pittsburgh, a lot of those representatives in 1902 played for that for that Oil City team on Thanksgiving Day. That was a lot of they played with Ben Roller, and they were the ones that had the tie. And I think they played the previous game where they beat Franklin 6-5. So, and it was such a downer for Franklin not to be able to play Oil City directly. But when they finally, and they tried scheduling East End all season long, I think there was two or three times where East End was promising to play and then they'd cancel at the last minute because they're saying, this Franklin team might be pretty good. Maybe we don't want to travel up there and play them. It's sort of what it felt like. And finally they did play I believe it was the last game of the season, of the regular season. And it was sort of Franklin saying, okay, we don't get to play Oil City, but these guys were Oil City last year. So we're going to envision them being Oil City. And Oil City people came up and were betting on East End to beat Franklin. So it was a way for the fans to sort of get their money back gambling without being really, they're Oil City by proxy. And just, I think they got some satisfaction, maybe not the players as much because only one or two of them was there in 1902, but definitely the General Charles Miller and Joseph Sibley and Dave Prince and some of the other fans that were supporters of the team and wagering on the team, I think got a lot of satisfaction from East End. So I think that would be the game I'd love to see.
Yeah, and some of the descriptions that you gave of what the crowd was doing and sounded like there was some pretty broken language on the sidelines and things like that. So sounds like it would have been a lot of fun to see. So One of the things about this team is, of course, you know, Dave Prince had to try to line up opponents and things like that. And you know, as someone who's writing about a team like this that most people have never heard of, one of the hardest things to do is to try to establish just how good they were based on the opponents that they played, right? And so was there a team that you saw that Dave Prince was trying to line up that, gosh darn it, you wish they would have played that team to help maybe elevate their standing a little more?
Well, I think definitely Oil City would have been a great one to play. If Oil City could have put together the team that they had in 1902, I think that would have been a great thing, because it was a great team. Franklin had a really good team in 1902. They just got outmanned by having that, you know, that athletics team come in and some of those East Enders playing for it. They tried to get Watertown in the regular season to play each other, and Watertown was sort of reluctant to play. And I think that's sort of why Watertown ended up sponsoring what we call the second World Series of football. They called it the World Championship at Madison Square Garden or something along those lines, but they ended up picking up the tab. Their owner and financer ended up putting up the $12,000 or $1,200 prize, and the second prize was $750. He was doing it trying to figure out a way to make a buck off of him playing Franklin, I think, and why not put it in the biggest city in the world at the time, and in a nice venue like Madison Square Garden. And you know, they had a tournament the year before that wasn't exactly a spectacular success, but there was some little bit of prominence there. Maybe they, you know, had some momentum to have football played there, and so that was. I mean, so I was glad that they finally played them and there was no guarantee they were going to play each other. They both had to win their first games to get in there first, but they put together a very formidable four teams in that tournament that were playing, you know, Franklin and Watertown and the Oreos of New Jersey, the Oreo Club, and Orange, New Jersey as well. Very good teams. Those were two of Franklin's closest games. Both with Watertown and with the Orange Athletic Club were 12-0 games, very, very tight. And the Syracuse Athletic Club, and Syracuse had won the tournament the year prior with some of Watertown's players. The Watertown's backfield with the Syracuse 11, you know, up front. But of course, they had the Pierce brothers that played for Carlisle, Holly and Bemis Pierce played on that Syracuse team in 1902, and Bill Warner and his brother Pop Warner also played on that team in 1902. And they were sort of a surprise to win in 1902, but they gave Franklin all they could handle in Franklin, another 12-0 game for Franklin, but it was another tough outing. They really only had one game where they scheduled that they knew that they were probably going to win it pretty big. And that was a local college from Meadville, Pennsylvania, Allegheny College. And actually, that's where my father worked at and retired from Allegheny College, not back in 1903, but in more modern times. But every team that they scheduled, and it was kind of amazing, all their regular season games were home games. And when I first saw that, I'm thinking, God, that's weird. Why, you know, no wonder they were undefeated. They had all these home games. Well, it made sense once you got into it, because at the time you had to, common thing was for the home team to pay the expenses for the visiting team to travel down. If they needed fed, they'd feed them. If they needed to stay overnight, they'd take care of all their expenses. And you had to guarantee that, because you might not get the money to pay for that. It might cost them $1,000 to do that, which is big money at that time. And when you're charging, you know, a quarter or 50 cents a ticket, you need a lot of people to make up $1,000 and pay your own players. So, but Franklin had the wherewithal and the funds to do that by their financial backing. So that's why they were able to bring teams in to play them. And they didn't bring, you know, cupcakes in to do them. They tried to find the best, most talented rosters they could to come and play them. Some wouldn't come play them. Oil City wouldn't come play them. East End, you know, took a couple times to finally get them up there. But, you know, Youngstown Athletic Club out of Youngstown, Ohio, at Primrose Athletic Club, you know, out of Pittsburgh. These were big-time teams and touting themselves as being, you know, world champions coming into this. You know, they were, you know, coming in advertised as being, you know, the teams to beat in their respective areas. Jamestown, New York, the Syracuse team was had a really, I think they tied Watertown earlier in the season. So they were feeling pretty good about themselves. So all these teams came in feeling pretty high on the hog, and Franklin sort of humbled them once they got to town.
Well, yeah, they usually won by large margins. And you mentioned that they would sort of apologize to the locals afterward. Like, we promised they were a good team, but we're just better, basically. So, and that sort of leads me to the last question that I had. And that is, you know, and you kind of touch on this in the book, on how, you know, they didn't have a team after 1903. And so, I mean, they were on top when they decided not to continue. I have a feeling that you sort of have a thought about that in terms of the wisdom of it. I don't know. I had a sense of that in the book.
Yeah. I don't think, you know, first of all, it wasn't like General Charles Miller and Joseph Sibley made money off of it. I think they were, you know, they were losing money from that. You know, first of all, you're putting a team up for 2 months in your hotels, and you're feeding them in your town, and you're paying them a wage, and you're making them happy. You're paying for teams to come in and play them. And the gambling wasn't what they thought it would be, because other than playing Syracuse and East End and playing up at Madison Square Garden, that's the only times you really had some other teams that had some money to play. You know, Allegheny College, they weren't going to have anybody to bet against them, you know, against them. Probably, you know, Primrose and Youngstown, they probably wasn't much wagering action for them to make money. So, and they did up in Madison Square Garden, they won the prize money, which they gave to the players, but they also had some lucrative bets outside with the Watertown faithful, and probably got close to breaking even, but that wasn't, I think, totally it. I think they had nothing else they could prove. They had a team that was undefeated, unscored upon, only a handful, only a couple times teams cross midfield against their defense. Their offense, you know, without the forward pass, only running the ball, was scoring darn near a point a minute in an era where there was the point a minute teams at Michigan who were only scoring like 0.7 points per minute. You know, Franklin, with touchdowns being worth 5 points, scored, you know, over 0.9 points per minute. If touchdowns were worth 6 points like they are today, it would have been over a point a minute. So think about that for a second. That's amazing to have a dominant defense, probably the most dominant offense I've ever heard of, scoring, and, you know, obliterating your opponents and, you know, setting the world on fire. So I think that had something to do with it. They really couldn't go any further than that. And I think it sort of made some dominoes fall. Pennsylvania was sort of the birthplace of professional football in the early 1890s with Pudge Heffelfinger and John Brailier and such. And it sort of grew up there. And that's sort of where the power of pro football was. That's where the good teams were. Well, 1903, that was in Franklin, still in Western Pennsylvania. After that, you don't hear about Western Pennsylvania football till the 1930s when the Steelers come in, and God, they don't do anything till the 1970s. So really, the shift of power in Pennsylvania, and most of those players transferring over to Ohio and playing in the Cantons and Massillons, which aren't that far away, because Franklin's not that far from the Pennsylvania-Ohio border either. And I think that was a paradigm shift in pro football there, and sort of went to the Midwest from sort of the Eastern, if you call Pennsylvania the Eastern state. And I think it also, set some things forward on, you know, propelling the professional football to a whole new place too, because teams weren't able to build a powerhouse team like that anymore. And I think that's sort of maybe, you know, maybe we forget about it, but maybe the NFL is pretty smart in having this parity in the league, so we don't have a team that's, you know, one dominant team. That's great for the fans of that team, but the rest of them, you know, can you imagine being a Syracuse fan thinking, hey, my team is undefeated, we won the World Series of Football last year, and you go in and you get beat 12-0, you can't get over midfield. You know, that'd be kind of humbling. So I think it did a lot for football, some lessons that we should learn. We don't ever want to have a team like that again. You know, I don't prescribe to it, but you want to honor what these guys did, because they played by the rules and they did what they had to do, and they did it very well.
All right. So you got another project?
I've got a couple in the hopper I'm working
Yeah.
on. Yeah,
Okay.
sort of again, Western Pennsylvania themed with the football. So, but some good stories. I'm want to try to do some story on Coach Andy Smith, who coached the Cal Wonder teams of the 1920s, four national championships, 1920 through 1923. And had some great teams. He's actually from DuBois, Pennsylvania, originally played at Penn State and played for the Penn Quakers, University of Pennsylvania, when he was in college and coached those teams too before he went to Cal. So I haven't seen a lot on him written. I'll tell his story a little bit. And we got some other things cooking too.
All right. Well, that's great to hear. Once you get the bug, it's kind of hard to stop, isn't it? All right. Well, thanks, Darren. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this. And I guess I just want to mention to people, if they don't know, that I have been on the show a couple of times here, and I just want everyone to know that I do have a couple of books out there myself, Mill City Scrum and Border Boys by R.C. Christensen, both about some early pro football, and I'm working on a new one as well. So you and I, Darren, when we get done with this podcast, maybe we'll talk about both those things a little bit more.
Yeah, and folks, you got to get the RC's books because these things are great. I mean, the Border Boys is I mean, it's a fascinating look of something that we here, most of us in the States don't appreciate, but sort of that Midwest Canadian US border with these players playing back and forth, and it's a great story there, and some things I learned a lot from that. And the Mill City Scrum, learning a lot about Minnesota football and especially the Twin Cities, which I found extremely fascinating. I'm not familiar with that area, so I learned a lot about that too. And there's some great players that you'll recognize that came out of those areas that had started their careers and had some great careers there. So I definitely highly recommend both those books and go back and listen to the podcast that RC was on. He talks about both of those books. I think we talked about the first book a couple different times. Mill City Scrum, we talked about that earlier this year in 2023. You can go in the search of Pigskin Dispatch and just type in those and you'll find in the podcast will come up in the stories. And also RC was talking about was an expert on one of our Rose Bowl shows we did a year ago now. Doesn't seem like a year ago, but gosh, the time flies.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Darren.
Well, RC, I really appreciate you coming on here and sort of reversing the tables on me and for reading the book and taking interest enough to suggest this and talk about it, and I really appreciate that.
All right. Well, thank you.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that. Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.